Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Mark Gislow, and I'm on the Board of Trustees here at East Shore Unitarian Universalist Church. I would like to extend a special welcome to any newcomers who are with us this morning, and I encourage you to spend some time getting to know us. If you would like to be on the mailing list, we invite you to sign up at the greeter's table. You will find additional information in the pamphlet rack in the narthex. Our greeters will be happy to answer any questions, and please join us for coffee and conversation in the back of the sanctuary following the service. Now, sharing the words of Reverend Chris Shiner, our denomination is unique because every Unitarian Universalist has the right to develop a personal philosophy of life without being told what to believe. We can learn from all philosophies and religions, and also from science and the arts. We explore important life issues in a caring community united by shared values rather than by shared theological opinions. And no matter what we do believe about theology or philosophy, we try to live a good life and leave the world better than we found it.
Do you ever break vows that you've made? Are you ever dismissive of or impatient with the person you married? The person that you vowed to honor and support more than anyone else in the world? We're human, so we all do it. We all break our vows in little ways sometimes. Every morning in my prayer, I make 5 vows, 3 times each. I vow to be oneness, firm in my dignity, but then I sell myself short in order to make things easier on myself. I vow to be diversity, to be a small but significant part of the interconnected web of all existence. Then I make myself greater than I am by doing something convenient but wasteful. I vow to be harmony by practicing as best as I can justice, equity, and compassion, and accepting other people and upholding the democratic process as we seek truth and meaning in our spiritual journeys, then I dismiss as ineffective some complex part of that equation. I vow to penetrate the unknown, to talk less and listen more. Then I shut down when I think I know the answers. I vow to bear witness, and then sometimes I just hide when it all feels like it's too much. I break my vows like everyone else, and then I come here, and I look into all of your faces, and I'm reminded of the song by Lynn Unger that's adapted from a poem by Rumi. But she left one line out, and it's a hopeful line, a generous line, a reminder that we can help each other uphold the vows that we make together every Sunday. To love, revere, discover, and connect as we journey together, even when we don't agree. Now, the Rumi poem goes like this. Come, come, whoever you are, wanderer, worshiper, lover of leaving. Though we've broken our vows 1,000 times, ours is no caravan of despair. Come yet again, come. So I'd like to invite you now to arise and open your gray hymnals to the number 188. And we're going to sing this a little bit differently this morning. The choir is going to come up, and we're going to have folks on this side and folks on that side. So we're going to have the choir sing it through once, and then we're going to join the choir, and then that side will start, and then that side will start. And if you can't get what I just said, just follow the choir, okay? But we're going to start all of this by saying that missing line together 3 times, though we've broken our vows 1,000 times. Though we've broken our vows 1,000 times. Though we've broken our vows 1,000 times. Though we've broken our vows 1,000 times.
Ours is no care of an object.
did it! I thought it was great. So I'd like to share with you a reading called The Great Teachers in Life by Jason Cook. We seekers are on a quest to discover truth and meaning. Sometimes we think we've found it, wrapped up, glimmering with newness, straight off the intellectual assembly line. All the answers right here for us, and others, if they'd only listen. But truth has a way of coming in disguise, sometimes wearing rags and sometimes finery, but so often cloaked from our immediate sight. And sometimes that which we have rejected, that which we have let go of or decided was only for others, but not for us, can be our teacher. Let our time of worship be an acknowledgement of the never-ending journey toward truth and meaning, and our appreciation of those we learn from along the way. Hey, Ashley, would you do us the honor of lighting the chalice this morning? You can do that, right? As you light, I'm going to share a reading, okay? And it's from the Upanishads, which is one of the oldest and most revered sacred texts of the Hindu faith. We light this chalice to help us move from untruth to truth, to help us move from ignorance to wisdom, to help us move from animosity to love, to help us move from bondage to freedom. We rededicate ourselves before this light to affirm and practice truth, wisdom, love, and freedom today and in the days to come. Thanks, Mark. Thanks, Ashley. So this is the first Sunday of the month, and on the first Sunday of the month, we always make an offering to people in need in our community. This month, whatever we collect is going to be brought to the Salvation Army in Painesville. So if you have anything, please bring it up and put it in one of the wagons, or you can hold it up, and I bet that Ashley or Maura or Caleb would be happy to come and get it for you. And as that happens, let's sing number 1010, We Give Thanks. You know, a lot of different religions, a lot of different religious traditions share stories. But some of them are adapted from an older tradition, and some are so universal, so common to the human experience, that they arise out of their own time and culture, and they're really similar to the tales of other times and other cultures. And the story I want to share with you this morning is one of those stories. It comes from the Sufi tradition of Islam, but it also comes from the Jewish tradition, and the Jewish version of this is what's on the front cover of the Order of Service this morning. And it comes from other traditions too. But this one goes like this. There was a king whose kingdom stretched from east to west, from the sea below to the moon above. It was vast. You would have thought he had everything he could possibly want, but no, his wishes and desires had no end to them. One day, troubled by a melancholy mood, he conceived a new desire. He ordered his wise men to assemble before him, and they came to hear the king's command. He told them, "You must make for me a ring of pure gold, and its power must be so great that when I look at it, my sorrow will turn to joy, and my joy will turn to sorrow." The wise men were perplexed. They might lose their lives if they could not fulfill the king's command. Now, they knew of rings that could summon demons, which they called jinns. And they'd also heard about rings that could give their owners the power of flight. But none of them knew of rings that could, at a glance, turn sorrow to joy and joy to sorrow. So at last, the wise men agreed on a plan. And they told the jewelers and the locksmiths who joined together to work the metal and engrave it. The work was long and tedious, but at last the ring was ready. And when the appointed day came, they again assembled before the king and ceremoniously presented him with the wonder-working ring. It was of pure gold, and on it was the transcription, "In time, this too shall pass away." Jared.
May love follow you throughout all your days. Insight, passion, joy, and beauty, faith, goodwill, and peace. May love follow you. May love follow you throughout all your days. Insight, passion, joy, and beauty, faith, goodwill, and peace. May love follow you. May love follow you throughout all your days. Insight, passion, joy, and beauty, faith, goodwill, and peace. Whoops. May love follow you.
See ya. You guys are going to class today, right? Oh. That was the thing. This is cute.
It's a little homebrew.
This really is the thing I love about congregational life. You never know what's going to happen. So when you came in, you had a chance to take a stone from the bowl at the top of the aisle. And if you forgot to get one, feel free to get one now. Or maybe you did like I did and came in with a stone from another place. Or maybe you've been carrying a stone from last week in your pocket all week as kind of a talisman. Now, whether or not you have a stone, maybe you have a ring or some other jewelry on you. Something that's a reminder of a sacred relationship that has had the power to transform you, to get through the tough times and help you feel uplifted and even powerful in the good times. You can hold on to that or be mindful of it. So please take a moment now to breathe deeply and ground yourself in this time and this space as we share our joys and cares, the milestones in our lives that are worthy of giving voice to, as we bear witness to one another's lives by placing those cares in the center of our space, under our beacon, and at the center of our time together. This morning, Jared writes that one of his the husband of one of his coworkers will be having surgery to help with ongoing heart issues, and asks that you please keep them in your thoughts, prayers, and other good vibrations. And Clark, any good news yet out of New York?
No.
So Shirley is not a granny again.
February 29th.
Oh, I was sure we'd be hearing something this morning. And we take time now to remember Dale Hudson, Gene Lefschetz, Jesse Valley Jr., Dana Walk, and Trevor Wetzlar, their families and their friends, after the five were shot by a coworker on Wednesday as they worked in a brewery in Milwaukee. Our remembrances, our thoughts, and our prayers are not enough. May we have the courage to change everything that needs to be changed in order to break the seemingly endless violence in our nation and our world. May we each remember that as Unitarian Universalists, we vow to keep engaging in this work and this tough conversation, even when it isn't easy. For these and all the joys and cares that remain unspoken, we observe a moment of silent meditation. Please come forward now, place your stones in the bowl on the altar in the center of our space. Thank you. Let's close this time of sharing our joys and cares by reading together a responsive prayer by Henry David Thoreau. Please remain seated and open your gray hymnals to number 660. And I'll read the parts in regular print and invite you to respond by reading the parts in italics. Why should we live in such a hurry and waste of life?
We are determined to be starved before we are hungry.
I wish to live deliberately, to front only the essential facts of life.
I wish to learn what life has to teach, and not, when I have come to die, discover that I have not lived.
I do not wish to live what is not life. Living is so dear.
Nor do I wish to practice resignation unless it is quite necessary.
I wish to live deep and suck out all the marrow of life.
I want to cut a broad swath to drive life into a corner and reduce it to its lowest terms.
If it proves to be mean, than to get the whole and genuine meanness of it and publish its meanness to the world.
Or if it is sublime, to know it by experience and to be able to give a true account of it.
This is the autobiography in five short chapters by Portia Nelson. Chapter 1. I walk down the street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I fall in. I am lost. I am helpless. It isn't my fault. It takes me forever to find my way out. Chapter 2. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I pretend I don't see it. I fall in again. I can't believe I am in the same place, but it isn't my fault. It still takes a long time to get out. Chapter 3. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I see it is there. I still fall in. It's a habit. My eyes are open. I know where I am. It is my fault. I get out immediately. Chapter 4. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I walk around it. Chapter 5. I walk down another street.
Come, thou fount of every blessing, tune my heart to know thy grace. Streams of mercy never ceasing, call for songs of loudest praise. In the steadfast pull of the ocean, if we are sung by rushing winds above, to praise the ground we walk upon it, ground of thy redeeming love. Bring our lives and souls together here on earth where we
tradition is always evolving. We have sacred texts and practices and traditions that we borrowed from others, and some we grew out of our own soil. Hopefully, everyone is reasonably familiar with our seven principles, the covenant made and upheld by congregations in our association. You can find them printed in the front of either hymnal. And I often sum them up this way. The first principle is about the primacy of the individual, the dignity, the incredible worth, the incredible light of every one of us. And the seventh is about the interconnectedness of all being, the power of the whole, and how much we need each other to survive. And the five principles in between are about how we maintain the harmony and the dynamic tension between the first and the seventh. Principles 2 through 6 are the tools we use to bridge the gap between the individual and the collective. We haven't always had seven principles. Back in the 1980s, the seventh was added after a few years' work by a group of people we would now call eco-feminists. Back then, they were just called women. And they wanted more spirituality in our principles and to make it clear that together, we're committed to dismantling false hierarchies like man over woman, humans over animals, and built over created. And these days, there's even talk within the Unitarian Universalist Association of adding an eighth principle. The wording is still a little clunky, but we'll wordsmith it. Journeying towards spiritual wholeness by working to build a diverse, multicultural, beloved community by our actions that accountably dismantle racism and other oppressions in ourselves and our institutions. 15 years ago, Paula Cole Jones, who was then Director of Racial and Social Justice for the Joseph Priestley District, started noticing and naming two different paradigms in UU circles. One primarily committed to the seven principles, and the other she calls seekers of beloved community, primarily committed to deep multiculturalism. Now, the latter group noticed that the seven principles could sometimes be used by the former group to justify any behavior that maintained the status quo. The proposed eighth principle seeks to address that duality and make it a thing of the past. And it's a slow-going process in the works now for a few years. But the seven principles, the covenant of the UUA, is really hard to change, not unlike the Constitution of the United States. The Equal Rights Amendment, the first version of which was introduced 97 years ago to Congress, still has not been adopted. It might not take quite that long to adopt the eighth principle. Changing our principles takes not just a supermajority of individuals to adopt it, it requires a consensus of all of our 1,000-plus member congregations. And some congregations, already driven by a hopeful vision of real multiculturalism among us, have adopted the eighth principle as one of their own congregational principles. And they're ready to do the work of getting it ratified. I think ratified is the right word. It should be the right word. The thing is that changing our core documents, our sacred texts as an association, takes a lot. But even if they remain unchanged officially, we're changing. Congregations are changing. They're adapting to this already. We're constantly changing with the times. Take the whole idea of universalism. The Universalist Church of America, from its inception as the Universalist General Convention in 1866, had a confession of faith. It was a creed that was agreed on by a consensus of participating members. And it was constantly evolving. It started off as simply the main premise of the faith, that life after death in heaven, in the company of God, was available to all, not just an elect few, and that we each have the capacity to make ourselves worthy of an eternal afterlife. Over time, more and more Universalist preachers adopted the notion that just about everyone, after death, eventually is restored to relationship with God through repentance after judgment. And for some, that transition was imagined to be quick, others saw it as slower. Few in that theology were excluded from heaven, until those crazy ultra-universalists came along and decided that, there's no hell at all. Everyone, they said, upon death, goes straight to heaven because God loves all of his children, period. No exceptions. Now, some people asked, what about the truly wicked among us? The truly evil, do they also go to heaven? But Universalists generally embrace this idea of God as all-loving and all-forgiving and jumped on the bandwagon. But then came World War I and the Depression and World War II, and along the way, a lot of Universalist clergy and lay people started thinking that hell is here on earth and heaven is what comes to us after we pass beyond this. Some preachers even started saying that heaven didn't, that not only did hell not exist, heaven didn't exist. In fact, some of them said, there's probably no God at all. So in the span of 95 years, from the beginning of Universalism as a unique denomination, through its consolidation with the Unitarians, again, only 95 years, the creed of Universalism went from thoroughly Christian to partly Christian, with a wide capacity for secular humanism. Not that Universalism was unique among faith in changing that dramatically over that period of time. The Unitarians were barely broken apart from the Congregational Church over the issue of Trinity versus unity when the Transcendentalists started questioning everything. Transcendentalism is one of those things that's always a little tough to talk about because the risk of oversimplification is great. But back in August, in a sermon, I said, Transcendentalism is about finding the voice of your thoughts and your belief, knowing who you are, not as a microcosm all unto itself, but as a part of something larger, something so vast at both the macro and micro levels that you can't even begin to understand. Transcendentalism is pushing yourself to that next level of understanding, that place just beyond the horizon. Transcendentalism is trusting in your soul, your essence, your innate intelligence enough to keep grasping for greater wisdom and maturity. Theodore Parker was one of the earliest Unitarian preachers to embrace Transcendentalism, and write about it in a way that was understanding to lay people at the time. He was arguably the most influential Unitarian that has ever lived. He was one of the first Congregationalists to embrace Unitarian theology, which made him so isolated from the mainstream that he had to preach the sermon at his own ordination. And thousands of people showed up. Parker, William Ellery Channing, and Ralph Waldo Emerson were among the most prolific writers about Unitarian theology of the time. And together, they defined what the nascent association would hold as its central principles. Principles we hold still to this day. One of Parker's earliest influential writings was a sermon called The Transient and Permanent in Christianity, delivered at the ordination of Charles Shackford in 1841. He wrote, "Looking at the word of Jesus, at real Christianity, the pure religion he taught, nothing appears more fixed and certain. Its influence widens as light extends. It deepens as the nations grow more wise. But, looking at the history of what men call Christianity, nothing seems more uncertain and perishable. Anyone who traces the history of what is called Christianity will see that nothing changes more from age to age than the doctrines taught as Christian, and insisting on as essential to Christianity and personal salvation. What is falsehood in one province passes for truth in another. The heresy of one age is the orthodox belief and only infallible rule of the next. If we're faithful, the great truths of morality and religion, the deep sentiment of love to man and love to God, are perceived intuitively and by instinct, as it were, though our theology be imperfect and miserable." Now, at the risk of oversimplifying this sermon, because the risk of oversimplifying this is as great as it is for transcendentalism, I want to sum up the sermon this way. Parker was saying that the truth that gives Christianity its moral and religious authority would stand, even without Jesus as God in a Trinitarian sense, because the truth that Jesus taught was more important and more permanent than the understanding, our understanding of who he was, which changes with the changing of times. In other words, as the world gets older and we humans become more experienced, our ideas about what any faith is evolve. Christianity or Judaism or Islam or Hinduism or any other religion may still have the same name, but it changes. And they express different values and sometimes even split into new factions. But the core beliefs remain the same, unchanged. For Christians, that means that as long as you love God with everything you have and love your neighbor as you love yourself, whether you believe in the Trinity or the Unity, you belong. And I think it's safe to say that for the American Project, that means that as long as you love democracy and defend it with everything you have and care for your neighbor as you care for yourself, whatever your religious affiliation, you belong. The irony is that the whole Trinity-Unity debate was huge in the 19th century. Everyone in this country in those days seemed to have skin in that game as a defining element of their personal theology. Nowadays, the bigger divide among Christians is not about the nature of Jesus, whether it's Trinity or Unity. That doesn't seem to be much of an issue. The divide is about Christians' relationship to Jesus. Is he your personal Lord and Savior? Is he your kind of get-out-of-jail-free card? Or is he the ultimate justice warrior demanding that you work to end oppression? Demanding that you visit the sick and feed the hungry and visit the impatient, visit the imprisoned. Times change, and our ideas of what is important change along with them, as does just about everything in this incredibly impermanent global culture that evolves as fast as technology changes. We can feel that here, amongst each other, as evidenced by the proposed eighth principle. And as different generations have very different expectations about who we are and what our commitments are to ourselves, each other, and the world, we are made up of our own experiences. We've each encountered the deep holes in the sidewalk on the road of our journeys, the difficulties that have forced us to stop and pay attention so we can learn to see things that we've been avoiding and maybe even take a different route. Every era has a different hole of its own, a different set of difficulties that everyone of that time has learned to navigate. The two world wars, the Great Depression, the Red Scare that spawned hyperconformity, Vietnam, civil rights movements, AIDS. They all forced us as communities and as a nation to stop and pay attention so that we can learn to see things that we've been avoiding and just deal with them. I find it amazing that there are adults among us, adults, who can't remember a time when we were not at war after 9/11. They can't remember a time when mass shootings weren't on the news every single week, a time when schools didn't have metal detectors and lockdown drills. And many of those adults are either in the armed services or public service. Their worldview, shaped by their shared experiences, shaped by the holes they encountered in the sidewalk, is affecting how we all operate as communities and as a nation. Every generation has its holes, but it also has its gifts of abundance, not the least of which are fueled by technological advances. They have good times and they have bad times. We have good times and bad times. And that ebb and flow is a constant reminder that this too shall pass. Wars begin, but they also end. The super wealthy, depending on tax structures and other external forces, have more and less power. In response to those forces, workers and the poor get lifted up and pushed back down again. The stock market generates confidence, even irrational exuberance, then takes it away when a new virus kills thousands of people. This too shall pass, the good and the bad. In the wake of all this fear and chaos, it's important to remember, as the king gifted with the ring learned, that this too shall pass away. Brian Thompson, a Zen practitioner, teacher, and author of Sparks to Awaken, writes, "One of the most important life lessons a person can learn is this too shall pass. It's a simple realization that all of existence is in constant state of transition. This moment, the way things are as they currently appear, shall change. And it already has. Everything is always changing. Every formation, every object, every structure, every person, every thought, every concept, every predicament, every event, every upset emotion, every happy feeling, every idea, every belief, all of these will pass." This is a happy thought to ponder, however, not a sad one, because without this constant state of transition, nothing would ever become. Without death, there can be no life. Without the transition from day to day, day to night, you could see no stars. Things must change. And things will change. Things are changing. So I say, maybe each of us should just look at the rings on our fingers, or the stones in the bowl on our altar, and use them as reminders that with time, this too shall pass away. And find comfort there. May it be so. Please rise now as you're willing and able, and open your gray hymnal as we join the choir in singing number 128, For All That Is Our Life. Man, things really have changed over the last century and a half, haven't they? In church, I mean, a century and a half ago, God was absolutely core. And now, you know, in our congregations, God is totally optional. In fact, I'd say not present a lot of times. Sermons lasted hours in those days. And families would buy pews in the congregation. And there were doors at the end of them that had their name on it, and you better not trespass. And on mornings like this, people would show up carrying iron boxes with coals from their fireplace, and that was what heated the space. You know, now most of the time, our furnaces work. But the thing that hasn't changed is that ministers still have to get up every Sunday and ask you all for money so that the furnaces can continue to work. And so that we can continue to do our work together. To make the world better and to make our own days glad. So I'd like to invite you now this morning to give as generously as you can as the collection baskets are passed. And if you're here for the first time, please let it pass you as our guest. Thank you for being here.
With the dawn to
sing the way the light, and softly serenade the stars, ever dance in circles in the night.
As a member of the Board of Trustees, it's my pleasure to thank everyone for your generous gifts to our congregation and the sharing that we do with our neighboring community as well. I serve as the financial secretary for the church this year, and I'm fortunate to work with a group of people who are very dedicated to making sure that we use those resources in the best way possible for the whole congregation. Next, we have the benediction by Reverend Scott Taylor. There is a wisdom woven into history, captured in myth and story, lodged somewhere deep inside each of us. It sits silently, patiently waiting, hoping we will listen, ready for us when we decide we are ready for it.
Announcements. Today, after coffee, there is a new to UU class on theology. That's open not just to newcomers, but to anybody who's interested in learning more a little bit more about theology, and more importantly, learning a little more about each other's theologies. This Wednesday is the first Wednesday of the month, so we're going to be gathering for dinner at 6 o'clock. John Hansen and his regular crew are planning on herb baked chicken, roasted cauliflower, and sweet potatoes with green salad and other fixings. Now, the great thing about these meals is that no matter what your dietary restrictions, you can eat heartily. We do a lot of hard work to make sure these are really accessible menus. Afterward, rather than having our usual worship, we're going to have the first session of a 5-part class being offered by 5 congregations here in Kirtland. This first one is going to be here in the sanctuary, so we'll have that instead of worship. And the class is called Life, Love, and Lent, Perspectives on Nonviolence. And this first session called Words is going to be presented by Seth Bryant of Kirtland Temple. The next 4 classes are going to take place over the following four Wednesday evenings. And each week it's going to be at a different church. So make sure you check out the posters and the website and the newsletter and everything else to get those locations. This is a great chance for all of us from different congregations to get to know each other so that we can hopefully do some work together as different congregations together here in Kirtland. Wednesday night, there's also going to be a finance committee meeting at 7. On Thursday, I'm going to be hosting beverages and banter from 2 to 4 at the Panera on Mentor near Melt. And next Saturday is a regular monthly all-church cleanup. So I want to encourage everybody born after 1965 to be there. So please. rise as you're willing and able. And if you're not feeling germy, because man, it is that season, feel free to take the hands of the person next to you. And if not, it's okay to cross your hands and your arms in front of yourself.
Thank you.
If you don't know the words to the bond of union, they're printed in the order of service. We join hands in Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, pledging ourselves to an individual religious freedom, which transcends all creeds, not to think alike, but to journey together.